Lecture 18, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, October 25th, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. So what we've done thus far in the course is the first half we spent learning some fundamentals of quantum mechanics. We then talked about what would happen if we had a very large number of quantum particles and we developed some distribution functions. Now what we want to do is put that large number of particles into a container, which we will call a solid, and try to develop the simplest theory of a solid. So we finally come to the point where we're talking about material science. It took a while to get here. And the first model we're going to develop is known as free electron theory. The assumption is that if you have a metal, the conduction electrons are free to move relatively freely throughout that metal. And as a result, the simplest potential you could imagine writing down to describe that situation would be one where the potential is zero everywhere except at the walls of that solid. So we call this free electron theory because the electrons are free to move within the solid, but they're still bound, of course, by the walls of the solid. So this will represent this simplest possible theory we could develop for a solid, known as free electron theory. And in this theory, we assume that the electrons in a solid experience no forces except at the impenetrable walls of the solid. And as a result, the potential, which is of course a three-dimensional potential, will be equal to zero if we assume the solid is existing in the x coordinate between 0 and L sub x, between 0 and L sub y in the y coordinate, and between 0 and L sub z in the z coordinate. So that's where the solid is located in space. There's no potential there. In infinity, otherwise. This is obviously an oversimplification of a solid, because in addition to the electrons, there are also the nuclei. Okay, so we're going to have to add the nuclei later. In reality, there's not going to be zero potential, but at least a periodic potential from the atoms in the crystal. So we're going to have to add periodicity later. And then finally, of course, there are defects present in solids, and those defects will lead to further chances for the electrons to interact with the solid or the nuclei themselves. In addition, the electrons could interact with one another. And what we're going to do is move through the remainder of the course adding more and more complexity. And if you take 451, we'll add even more complexity to develop a more and more accurate model of a solid. But we begin simply by assuming this is the case. The good news about this potential is that we've already solved it. This is a particle in a box. And the allowed energies are defined with respect to three quantum numbers, n sub x, n sub y, n sub z, and is equal to pi squared h bar squared over 2m times n sub x squared over l sub x squared for the x component. Remember how we would solve this problem is to do separation of variables in Cartesian coordinates, plus n sub y squared over l sub y squared, which would come out of the y coordinate, plus n sub z squared over l sub z squared, which would come from the z coordinate. What we're going to do to try to equate this back to the theory of free particles, remember that was the first potential we solved with the Schrodinger equation, we're going to let this be equal to h bar squared k squared over 2m. The reason why we're doing this is that the electrons in the solid, except at the boundaries, feel no potential, and so they're effectively free. We're going to find that the free particle solution is going to be applicable to electrons and solids with some constraints. But in an attempt to try to correlate the real energies with the free particle solution, we're going to define it, or we're going to introduce this parameter k. If you recall, the energy of a free particle is just h bar squared k squared over 2m. But now we can see exactly what K is equal to in a solid. So we're introducing K, where K is the magnitude of the wave vector of course, is K vector, and we'll have three components, Kx, Ky, Kz, where we can see by inspection of this equation compared to that equation that Kx, Y, and Z are equal to pi n sub x, y, and z divided by L, x, y, and z. Where, of course, the quantum numbers for the particle in a box are positive integers. So if you recall, for a truly free particle, K was a continuous variable. It could have any solution you want. In a solid, it is going to be quantized. But the spacing between the wave vectors is going to be very small because these dimensions here are macroscopic in size, centimeter, as opposed to angstroms. So the energy difference is going to be very, very small. And as a result, this will effectively be a continuous variable. So the approximation will be very similar to that of a free particle. The difference is that it is quantized and there is a finite number of available wave vectors, and so we're going to have to define a density of states, and that's where we're going today. So what does this tell us? In our effort to define or calculate the density of states, what I want you to do is imagine plotting a series of planes in this K dimension, or as we'll call it, K space. So I want to show you a picture of K space in this problem. So K space, of course, is three dimensions, Kx, Ky, and Kz. And if we were to draw in planes at Kx equal to pi over Lx, 2 pi over Lx, 3 pi over Lx, etc. If we were to plot planes for Ky equal to pi over Ly, 2 pi over Ly, etc. And K sub z to be pi over L sub z, 2 pi over L sub z, etc. Then we would get this plot here. The intersection of any three planes will, of course, be an allowed wave vector, right? Because the wave vector is quantized. And the only available quantum numbers are n sub x, n sub y, and n sub z equal to 1, 2, 3, etc. So each of these points represents a discrete state in K-space. And so a fair question to ask is, how much volume of K-space is taken up by one state? And so that's the shaded box here. As we know from introductory material science, if we were to calculate the number of atoms in a unit cell, or in this case the number of states inside of this box, we see that there are eight corners to this rectangular prism. And of course, each of them share that state with eight others. And as a result, we're going to have 1/8 times 8, or one state, in that box. The volume of that box, we can calculate directly, is just going to be equal to the spacing between the states, which is pi over Lx in the x direction, pi over Lz in the y direction, and pi over L sub z in the z direction. And so the volume of this will just be pi cubed divided by Lx, Ly, Lz. So we can write down from this diagram directly what the volume per state is in K-space. Is everybody comfortable with this picture here? Because this is a picture you want to keep in your mind. Because we're going to utilize this to derive the so-called density of states. Again, for material scientists, this is usually no problem because in courses as early as 201, you learn how to do the state counting. So from this purely geometrical argument, we can see that each state represents, or I should say each state occupies. A K-space volume which is pi cubed over Lx, Ly, Lz. Of course, Lx times Ly times Lz is just the real space volume of the solid. And as a result, the standard to write this as pi cubed over V, where V is the real space volume. A common problem in free electron theory is to reanalyze the problem in some reduced dimensionality system, like a 2D system, which would represent a thin film, or a 1D system, which would represent a nanowire, for example. And obviously, if you had a 2D system, you'd only have nx squared over lx squared plus ny squared over ly squared. And so you'd have a two-dimensional k-space. And as a result, the volume, or in that case, the area in k-space per state would be pi squared divided by Lx times Ly. Similarly, in 1D, you just have a length, which would be pi over L sub x. And if you wanted, you could generalize this to a higher dimensionality system, if you wanted, although that's probably less realistic physically. So this is really the fundamental point. There's one other thing we need to recognize. And that is, let's consider the case of T equals 0 Kelvin first. If these free particles were bosons or distinguishable particles, so at t equals zero, bosons or distinguishable particles would settle. To the ground state. Of course, is where nx, ny, and z are equal to 1. So they would collapse, they would condense, if you will, and this is the so-called Bose-Einstein condensate. But of course, in a solid, we don't have bosons, we have fermions. So however, electrons are fermions, that obey the Pauli exclusion principle. And as a result, only two electrons, and there's two, of course, because the Schrödinger equation does not include spin, and we now know that there's two possible values of spin for a fermion. So only two electrons can occupy each state. And as a result, if we were to pour electrons into a solid, they would, of course, occupy the lowest state, which would be psi 1-1 first, and you'd be able to put two into that state. But then you'd begin to fill up larger values of nx, ny, and z, and as a result, larger values of kx, ky, and kz. Of course, they're going to want to occupy the lowest energies first, and as a result, they're going to fill up to a value which minimizes the magnitude of k. So if you imagine in k-space some radial vector k, anything under that vector k is going to be filled up before you go above that vector k. So you're going to fill up k-space in a spherical manner. And as a result, what we're going to define is some wave vector, which we'll call k sub f, which we know as the Fermi wave vector, which will represent the boundary between the occupied and the unoccupied states at t equals 0 Kelvin. What we'll then do is turn on temperature, and obviously we'll have the possibility of promoting states thermally to values greater than the Fermi wave vector. Okay. So let's write this down. If we had capital N electrons, they will fill up one octant of a sphere in k-space. Whose radius, k sub f, is determined by the fact that each pair of electrons requires a k-space volume of pi cubed over v, which is what we just showed. Okay. A common question when people first see this is, why on earth is it only one octant as opposed to all of the sphere? Of course, this is because there are constraints on the quantum numbers nx, ny, and z. They can only be positive integers. So if you're only going to allow positive values of kx, positive values of ky, and positive values of kz, then it's only going to fill up 1/8 of the possible sphere. And as a result, we would say that 1/8 times the volume of a sphere, which is, of course, is 4/3 pi kf cubed, will be equal to n, number of electrons, times the volume that each of them takes up, which is pi cubed over v divided by 2, due to the value, or due to the fact that there's two possible values of spin. And as a result, we can see that the Fermi wave vector is only a function of the number of electrons in the solid. It will be equal to 3 pi squared n over 1/3, where n is equal to the number of electrons divided by v, or that is the number of electrons per unit volume, also known as the electron concentration or the electron density or the carrier concentration or carrier density. You may have heard of any of these terms in the past. Okay. So I've done a solve for kF here. So this is exactly what we expect. As we pour more and more electrons into the solid, we'll fill up a larger and larger amount of k-space, and the Fermi wave vector will increase. And it increases by the 1/3 power of n. That results from the fact that we're in three dimensions. You can imagine in a lower dimensionality system that exponent would differ. The boundary between occupied and unoccupied states in k-space at t equals 0 Kelvin is called the Fermi surface, and in free electron theory, the Fermi surface is simply a sphere. I should point out, though, that in a real solid, the Fermi surface can have a much more complex shape, and that leads to some of the subtle differences between different metals. You know, copper and aluminum are not the same due to differences in the shape of their Fermi surfaces. That'll be a correction we'll have to make to the theory later on. But for now, we're assuming they're just free, and as a result, the Fermi surface is simple. It's a sphere. That makes life easy, because it's easy to calculate volumes and surface areas of spheres. But if you had a material which had a more complex Fermi surface, you may find that Fermi surface is such that it's not easy to calculate volume or not easy to calculate surface area. And so I'm going to show you two different ways to get at the density of states, depending upon whether or not the surface area or the volume of the Fermi surfaces easier to calculate. Okay. So that's called the Fermi surface. The corresponding energy is called the Fermi energy. Sometimes referred to as the Fermi level. E sub f, which is equal to h bar squared kf squared over 2m. We now know what kf is equal to, and so we can express now the Fermi energy, which is only a function of the number of carriers. It's h bar squared over 2m, 3 pi squared n to the 2/3 power. Okay. So if you know the number of electrons, you can calculate the Fermi energy. This represents the boundary between the occupied and the unoccupied states.
Now, the important question, which we're going to try to answer now, which will allow us to employ free electron theory later on, is how many electrons exist in K plus dK. So if we had a differential change in K, how many electrons exist? And there are two approaches to this problem. And again, it depends on the shape of the Fermi surface, which will be easier to accomplish. The first approach is the approach shown in Griffiths, which is to multiply the surface area of the Fermi surface by dK. Because if we think about this, what we're calculating is how many electrons exist in a volume, which is the surface area times dK. So it's a shell of thickness dK. So calculate the volume that you take the surface area times dK. Once you have the volume, you can calculate how many states are present just by dividing it by the volume per state, which we know is pi cubed over 2v. And so this is one way to get at it, if you can calculate the surface area easily. So multiply the surface area by dK and divide by the K space volume per state. And as a result, the differential number of electrons that exist between K and dK will just be equal to the surface area. Of course, it's the surface area of an octant of a sphere, so it's going to be 1/8 times the surface area of a sphere, which is 4 pi K squared, times the thickness of the shell, which is dK, so that represents a volume. We'll divide it by the volume per state, which is pi cubed divided by 2V. And as a result, we can simplify this and recognize that dN is equal to V divided by pi squared K squared dK. We could, of course, divide both sides of this equation by V, and dN over V is just d lowercase n, or the concentration of electrons. And as a result, we see that d lowercase n is just k squared over pi squared dK. Okay. Obviously, you get a different relationship if you did this in two dimensions or one dimension. And that, of course, leads to interesting properties, and hence the excitement in the field of nanotechnology nowadays, where you can exploit lower dimensionality materials. So that's one way to get at it, which is easy if you know the surface area. If you don't know the surface area, then what you can do is determine the total number of states as a function of K, and then differentiate. Right, if you want to calculate dN dK, you can just calculate n as a function of K and take the derivative. And that's all surface area is, right? Surface area is the derivative of the volume. And so this makes sense. So let's do an example. For example, for a spherical Fermi surface like we have in this problem, we just showed that K was equal to 3 pi squared n to the 1/3 power, which of course implies that n is equal to K cubed over 3 pi squared. And as a result, if we took the derivative dn, the derivative of K cubed is just 3 K squared. The 3's will cancel and we'll get out K squared over pi squared dK, and as expected, it agrees with the alternative approach that we employed. So if you've seen this before, you're probably shown one or the other approaches. I like to show both because it gives you the most flexibility. Okay. Now, it's customary to express the density states not in terms of the wave vector, but in terms of energy. So we have to do a variable transformation. So we remember that E is equal to h bar squared k squared over 2m, which of course implies that dE is equal to h bar squared k over m dk. And as a result, we can substitute in k squared equal to 2me over h bar squared for that term, dk equal to m over h bar squared k for dk. And as a result, dn will be equal to 1 over pi squared. Time substituting for k squared, we get 2me over h bar squared. Then we substitute in for dk. Dk is equal to m over h bar squared k dE. We still have it in terms of k. So we also recognize that k is equal to square root 2me over h bar. So we substitute that in at this point. And as a result, we can write dn is equal to 1 over pi squared 2m squared e over h bar to the fourth times h bar over square root 2me dE. We'll collect terms and recognize that the energy dependence of dn is e to the 1 half power, because we have e divided by square root of e. And as a result, this is equal to 1 over 2 pi squared 2m over h bar squared to the 3 halves times energy to the 1 half dE. And as a result, we can see that the density, so-called density of states G, which is just equal to dN dE, is equal to 1 over 2 pi squared divided by 2m over h bar squared to the 3 halves times energy to the 1 half. Okay. This is the so-called density of states. Absolutely critical, the direct consequence of the particle in a box. The density of states in three dimensions, you see, goes as energy to the 1 half power. What that implies is that when energy goes to zero, for example, if you're at a band edge in a solid, that the density of states goes to zero. You'll find in a two-dimensional material, so you may want to do this for fun, calculate the density of states in 2D and find that the energy dependence is e to the zeroth power. That is, it is constant as a function of energy. And in one dimension, you'll find the density states goes as energy in the minus 1 half power. So 1D material is the exact opposite of a 3D material. In a 3D material, the density of states goes to zero at a band edge, whereas in a 1D material, the density of states becomes a singularity. These singularities in 1D materials are known as Van Hove singularities and have very dramatic consequences for the electrical and optical properties of 1D materials, such as carbon nanotubes. Carbon nanotubes have very sharp peaks in their optical absorption spectrum, which directly results from the fact that the density of states goes as energy to the minus 1 half as opposed to energy to the 1 half power. So we're finally getting to the point in the class where I can give you many examples from real materials where these equations we're deriving have direct consequences on the properties of matter. Is everybody comfortable with this derivation? Okay. I apologize if you've seen it before. It's covered in most undergraduate courses, but it's so useful and fundamental that it's worth doing it again, in my opinion. So we can do many manipulations. Let's do a few to show sort of the relationship between Fermi energy, density of states, etc. So recall the Fermi energy is h bar squared kf squared over 2m, which is just equal to h bar squared over 2m times 3 pi squared n to the 2/3 power. And as a result, ef to the 3 halves power will be equal to h bar squared over 2m to the 3 halves times 3 pi squared times n. And as a result, the density of states evaluated at the Fermi energy will be equal to 1 over 2 pi squared times 2m over h bar squared to the 3 halves times EF to the 1 half. That's, of course, equivalent to EF to the 3 halves divided by EF. And as a result, we can substitute in this value, which we just derived here, into this equation and recognize that the density states at the Fermi energy is 1 over 2 pi squared times 2m over h bar squared quantity to the 3 halves power times h bar squared over 2m, again to the 3 halves power, times 3 pi squared n over EF. And you'll recognize that almost everything cancels here, such that the density states at the Fermi energy is simply equal to 3n over 2EF. This is a very concise and useful equation. It'll be expected that you'll know it from here on. In 451, for example, it'll show up surprisingly, perhaps, in the theory of magnetism, and will show up in many other times in solid-state physics. So I derive it here explicitly. Okay. Next question. What is the total energy of the free electron gas? Okay, I haven't used the word free electron gas yet, but it becomes a good way of thinking about the problem here. So we have our particles in a box, which are free to move, and they behave very much like a gas. And if you think about gas molecules in a vacuum chamber, they will exert a pressure on the walls of the chamber. In the same way, the free electrons will exert a pressure on the walls of the solid, and this will contribute to the compressibility of any material which has conduction electrons in it. This is a real property which we're going to calculate, which will be a direct consequence of the fact that the Pauli exclusion principle holds and induces the electrons to occupy higher and higher energies. Okay. So how do we solve this problem? We go back to our k-space density of the k-space definition of the density of states, that is dn equals k squared over pi squared dk. That implies that d capital N, since n is, or lowercase n is capital N over v, d capital N is equal to v over pi squared k squared dk. Incidentally, if you go from textbook to textbook, for example, between Griffiths and Cattell, Cattell will define the density of states in this way in terms of the capital N, and as a result, there's a term v in the density of states, whereas in Griffiths, they do in terms of lowercase n, so there's no v. So you should be able to convert between those two just by keeping track of whether or not you're talking about a concentration or the number of carriers. Okay. So we know this is the case. That's how many number of electrons exist for a certain shell of with dk. Each of the electrons in this shell between k and k plus dk carries an energy, which is h bar squared k squared over 2m. So if you multiply the energy per electron times the number of electrons, then we'll know what the energy is in that shell. And then all we do is we integrate over all possible shells from 0 up to the Fermi energy, or the Fermi wave vector. And that will tell us the total energy of all the electrons in the solid. So this implies that the energy of the shell, which I'm going to call the differential amount of energy, is equal to the energy per electron, which is h bar squared k squared over 2m, times the number of electrons, which is v over pi squared k squared dk. And as a result, the total energy is just equal to, we can pull all the constants out in front, h bar squared v over 2 pi squared m times an integral from 0 up to kf. So these are all the occupied levels or occupied states in the solid of k to the fourth dk. The integral of k to the fourth is k to the fifth divided by 5, evaluated at the bounds, which are kf and 0. And as a result, this integral is equal to h bar squared kf to the 5th times volume divided by 10 pi squared times the mass of the electron. But we know what kf is equal to. Kf is just equal to 3 pi squared n quantity to the 1/3 power, so we can substitute that into this equation. And as a result, the total energy is equal to h bar squared times 3 pi squared capital N to the 5/3 divided by 10 pi squared m times volume divided by volume to the 5/3 power, which is just equal to volume to the negative 2/3 power. Okay. And as I was alluding to, this quantum mechanical energy is equivalent to the internal energy of molecules in a vacuum chamber. So any ideal gas will have an internal energy. That internal energy will change as a function of the volume, and as a result will exert a pressure on the walls of the vessel, in this case the walls of the solid. Okay. In particular, you see it goes inversely with volume. And so if we were to increase the volume of the solid, the energy would drop. And as a result, that suggests there's a driving force or driving pressure which is pushing out on the walls of the solid. And so we're now going to calculate what that pressure is. It's known as the degeneracy pressure or the Pauli exclusion pressure, which is being exerted on the walls of any solid which has free electrons in it. And we'll make a measurable contribution to the compressibility of materials, at least metals. So to do this analysis, let's take the derivative with respect to volume. So dE total will be equal to the derivative of V to the negative 2/3 is negative 2/3 times V to the negative 5/3. So we'll get a negative 2/3 times all these constants, h bar squared, 3 pi squared n to the 5/3 divided by 10 pi squared m times v to the negative 5/3 dv. Of course, this term here is very similar to what the energy was, so we could substitute energy total into this equation, and as a result, write this concisely as negative 2/3 times the total energy times dv divided by V. And as I suggested, this manifests itself as a pressure being exerted on the walls of the solid. Or in the nomenclature of thermodynamics, this manifests itself as work done on the outside. And I know you covered this in 401 because I was subbing for Yipwa on the day. dW is equal to P dV. So this manifests itself as work done on the outside by the quantum pressure. And as a result, P will just be equal to 2/3 E total divided by V. And we could plug back in the value for E total if you like. This is equal to 2/3 H bar squared KF to the 5th over 10 pi squared times M. You could plug in what KF is equal to. So you can write this in many ways. I'm just giving you some examples. 3 pi squared to the 2/3 H bar squared over 5m times n to the 5/3. These are all equivalent. And as I've been saying, this is a real pressure being exerted on the outside walls of the solid. It's measurable. In 351, I have students calculate what it's equal to. And it contributes to the compressibility in the order of, say, 50% of the total compressibility of a metal. So it's a real contribution. And it's purely quantum mechanical. in nature results from the fact that the polyexclusion principle is at play here, and the electrons cannot pack down into the ground state. They're going to fill up and occupy a certain amount of K space. And as a result, this is also known as the degeneracy pressure or the exclusion pressure. And we see that even in the simplest theory of a solid, quantum mechanics immediately plays a dramatic role in influencing the real mechanical properties of materials. Many people think that solid-state physics only is important for electrical and optical and magnetic properties, but we see that it's important for all properties of solids, including mechanical properties. Are there any questions on this introduction to free electron theory? If not, then we're going to start adding complexity. And of course, the one thing you've probably noticed here is that everything we've done thus far is at 0 Kelvin. Okay? And if we want to move on and talk about a real solid, we're going to have to add temperature. So at finite temperatures, we must consider the thermal distributions that we derived using quantum statistical mechanics. Okay. So the next level of complexity is to take free electron theory, which tells us the density of states, and add in the Fermi Dirac distribution function. Put them together and we'll be able to explain now temperature-dependent properties, for example, the specific heat capacity of a solid, which is a thermal property. So let me remind you of two things, two constraints from our analysis of quantum statistical mechanics. In particular, the total number of particles is the sum of the occupation numbers of each energy level. And the total energy, which I'm going to call capital U, this is equivalent to E total, will be equal to the sum from n equals 1 to infinity of the occupation number times the energy. Okay. So I'm introducing an additional notation because depending on what book you read, you'll see either E total or capital U. Capital U is especially nice because if you want to represent the specific total energy, you just divide capital U by capital V, as we did for the electron, and then this will just become lowercase u, so that'll represent the amount of energy per unit volume, just as lowercase n represents the number of particles per unit volume. So that's a little bit easier to write down than lowercase e subtotal. Okay. So here's the critical point, which is an important assumption here, which does not apply for all particles. For example, bosons, this assumption will go terribly wrong in the limit of low temperature because all the particles will crowd into the ground state. But for solids, this will be okay for all cases. So assuming that dE, the differential amount of energy between states, is small, and more than one state is occupied. And so as I just said, for fermions, this is certainly going to be the case because we can't crowd all the electrons into one state. But for bosons, they could crowd into one state. And as a result, this analysis will break down at low temperatures and lead to dramatic differences in properties, such as superfluidity of liquid helium. But for fermions, this will be a fair assumption in all cases. So assuming this is the case, these sums can be replaced by integrals. This is very similar to what we did for the free particle, if you recall. Remember when we were doing stationary state solutions of the Schrodinger equation, the general solution was an infinite sum over the stationary state solutions with some coefficient c sub n. But we said in the case of a free particle that the value k was a continuous variable, and as a result we converted that infinite sum into an integral and introduced a new parameter phi, which was the Fourier transform, if you recall. We're going to do something similar here. We're going to say the energy difference is small, and as a result you can replace these infinite sums with an integral. And in many cases, integrals are easier to manipulate than infinite sums. But if you want, you can always go back to the initial definition and execute the problem. And for some problems, for example, the three-dimensional harmonic oscillator, the infinite sums are actually more useful than the integrals we're going to write down. So let's write down these integrals. Instead of having capital N being a sum over n, capital N sub lowercase n, we're going to say that lowercase n, which is capital N over V, will be equal to an integral from 0 to infinity of the density of states times the probability of occupation, which is Fermi direct distribution function, dE. This represents particle density. Lowercase u, which is capital U over V, will just be equal to the integral from 0 to infinity of the energy times the density of states at that energy times the Fermi direct distribution function, which is the probability of occupation at particular energy, times dE. And this is quite nice because it allows us to handle any temperature quite readily. The density states we know, at least we've calculated in 3D. So assuming you're in 3D, then you can write down directly what the density of states is equal to. The Fermi direct distribution function is known. So assuming you have fermions, you just plug that into this equation. You typically know n in your problem. And so what you can do is utilize this integral to determine the only free parameter, which is the chemical potential mu. If you recall, the chemical potential is just a means of keeping track of how many particles are present. And so if you know how many particles are present, you can deduce what the chemical potential is. Once you have the chemical potential, then you can plug it into this equation and calculate what the energy density is. Once you have the energy density, you can calculate many parameters, such as the specific heat of your piece of material. So that's the approach that we're going to employ. Is everybody comfortable with these two equations? Okay. I think we should stop there. What we'll do next time is first utilize these new equations and plug in what the Fermi direct distribution function looks like at t equals 0 Kelvin. And of course, it's just a step function, as we wrote down last time. So this integral will simply become an integral from 0 to EF. This, of course, drops out because F is equal to 1 in that region. And you're just taking an integral from 0 to EF of the density of states. From that, we can pull out what the Fermi energy is as a function of N, and it better match the analysis we just did today. And we'll find that it does. We can then calculate the total energy utilizing this equation, because we'll now know what the Fermi energy is equal to. And this should match what we just did, and we could deduce the quantum pressure utilizing these two equations as opposed to the geometrical argument that we made today. What we'll then do is turn on temperature, because that's the whole point of this analysis, is not to do it at t equals 0 Kelvin, but at finite temperature. And to do that's going to require integrals over the Fermi direct distribution function. That's a very difficult integral to evaluate, so we'll spend about a day doing the so-called Sommerfeld expansion, which will tell us how to execute and handle integrals over the Fermi Dirac distribution function. And from that, we'll be able to calculate the specific heat of a metal.
MSE 405.